you could only be tuned to WRUV FM Burlington.
Hey, you! Have you drank enough water today? Staying hydrated is very important, even during the cold winter months. Drinking water is key to staying energized, attentive, and awake, especially when running on small amounts of sleep. It can also help with digestion and the immune system. This message has been brought to you by your dehydrogen monoxide, H2O. Drinking DJs at WRUV.
You're listening to WRUV FM Burlington. This is Pause. Dramatic Pause is DJ Not Ted. And I'm going to be playing something a little bit different. Normally, I do a lot of RPM music and rock and other things. And I haven't been in Burlington for a while, but I'm back up here. And I'm going to do 4 hours. It's going to be a talk radio show, which is shocking, anyone that knows me, about social engagement, sociology, a little bit of history, and talking about why you should be involved with WRUV or other community places, either at UVM or the Echo Center or in your community in general. So with that, we're going to start out with a talk that was done between Simon Sinek and Trevor Noah, talking about friendship, loneliness, and stuff like that. So I'm going to just play it, and you can always call here at 656-4399 if you have any ideas or suggestions about your feedback about the stuff I'm playing. That'd be great. I might even shout over the air about what you called about. So, yeah, number here, 802-656-4399. So let's get into it, and hopefully you do enjoy. You're listening to WRUV FM Burlington, DJ Not Ted.
A young schoolgirl named Patricia and her precocious classmate John.
Really, all I wanted to know, and it sort of is the genesis was yesterday, is what are you fascinated by right now? Because I know you're always working on something, or you're always drilling into something.
Yeah.
What are you fascinated by right now?
Well, it's interesting because the common theme that we've been hearing from all the talks today, which is the passion isn't some manufactured thing,
right?
Where you sort of find the passion and do what you're passionate. You know, passion is an output, not an input. And what we hear is somebody finds an obsession for something, and that then becomes their passion. And the same is definitely true, I'm sure, for you, and definitely true for me. So the thing that I'm sort of obsessing about right now is friendship. There's an entire industry to help us be better leaders. There's an entire industry to help us be better parents. There's an entire industry to help us eat better, exercise better, sleep better. And yet, there's barely anything on how to be a friend. And if you think about all the mental health challenges that so many of us are facing today, whether it's coping with stress, depression, anxiety, addiction, even obsession with longevity, friendship is the ultimate biohack that literally fixes all those things. Why would you care about friendship? Friendship is like, yeah, go out with your friends, hang out with your friends. Why would you care about friendship on like a global scale? What's in it, Simon? What's happening? So let me take one step back and try and get to an answer. Our understanding of addiction largely comes from an experiment that was done, I think, in like the 50s or 60s, where they put a rat in a cage, and there was one thing of water where it was plain water and one thing that was laced with drugs.
Right.
And in short order, the rat discovered the drug-laced beverage and loved it, drank more and more until it killed itself. And our understanding of addiction largely comes from this study. There was a guy named, I think his name is Bruce Alexander, who said, hold on, it's flawed. The whole study is flawed.
Oh.
Because rats, like us, are social animals. And we put a rat by itself in solitude. Of course it became an addict. But that's not what you're supposed to do with social animals. So he recreated the experiment where he put, like, first of all, he put lots of rats in the cage.
No way.
So social, community. They put like wheels and mazes, and they were having kids and babies and two waters, a plain water and the drug-laced water. And they could see from the data, they knew which ones, and they all tried enough of the drug-laced water to get addicted.
Right.
But they didn't. Their taking in of the water declined, and they only drank the plain water, which starts to give evidence that if we have close friendships and if we live in community, perhaps we're less susceptible to all addiction. And I know that there's a lot being talked about the addiction of social media, the addiction of cell phones, which is true. Mm-hmm. Which is true. It is a highly dopamine-producing device. And that it's causing loneliness.
And I just want to cut in here a little bit, just with that talk. That study that was did between the rats and the social environment. So there's a little bit more nuance about that study. That I want to cut in with and just talk about. So it's a little more complex on how the interaction between the social environment and drug addiction. So it's not 100%, even though he maybe implemented that in what he's talking about, but it's a little more nuanced. There's certain people are predispositioned to have a drug addiction, and there's other environmental factors or psychological factors that can play into drug addiction. So it's not, a lot of people kind of put that out there, but it's a part of it. And a lot of studies that have looked into this, there's a fair chunk of social isolation that can cause drug addiction. So later on, and I'll be bringing this up in a subject, they talk about that connection. There's a fair amount of connection between the pain centers in the brain and how humans socially interact. Social isolation basically hits the same part of your brain that pain does. So there's a fair amount of connection between those two, and that's why. But we'll get a little more into that more in detail later in another segment of the show that I'm going to do. But I want to cut in a little bit and just talk about that one thing, because it's obviously a sensitive subject and something that's a little more nuanced than a lot of people talk about. So anyway, we'll get right back to it. And like I said, you can always call 656-4399 if you have any comments or suggestions or things you want to talk about.
And I would argue that if we taught our children how to be friends, that perhaps they are less likely to get addicted. And I think, so when you talk about what's the global responsibility,
yeah,
we're teaching people how to do everything. You know, we're finding the hacks for everything. The
yeah.
one thing we aren't doing is the old-fashioned, hard, slow thing of making friends. You live a life where you're away a lot, you're
yeah.
on the road a lot. I mean, your career necessitates you to be on the road.
Right.
How has that affected your friendships? More important, what have you done to maintain the closeness of those friendships with the crazy life that you live?
I believe in uranium-enriched friendships. That's how I think about it. So I think a friendship, like I've tried to study friendships as much as I can, you know, over the past, maybe like, I've really focused on it over the past like 4 or 5 years. And I remember once I was in an interview and somebody said, hey, what's your goal? What's your dream? It was actually Forbes magazine. And I said, I would love to be successful, but I wish there was a top 10 list for somebody who has a friend's net worth. Because that's honestly what I'm trying to do. And maybe it's confirmation bias, but I find that answer, you know, keeps coming back to me. I was on a trip to Greece a few years ago. And, you know, if you've ever been to any of these places where people are on boats and having a great time in the water, it hypnotizes you. And I turned to one of the Greek guys I was with and I said, Nick, if I was trying to get a boat, what boat should I get? And I'll never forget this. His friend jumped in and he said, Ella, 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 Trevor, Ella, let me tell you something. The best boat is your friend's boat. And it was a joke that had so many layers to me. Because the one was, yeah, it's true. Like, you know, it is, if you own a boat, there's a lot of stress. You don't want to own a boat unless you really love boats. But the thing I found profound was this, was the fact that everybody who has a boat
yeah.
needs friends to be on that boat with them. And if everybody works to get the boat, no one has time to have friends to come on the boat with them. And every boat I know is full of friends who are on that boat.
Amen.
So,
amen.
You know what I mean? It's like
yeah.
And so to answer your question, what I've been doing is I recently got back. I just got back from Japan. We did a 10-day trip with 16 of my friends. that group has grown, and all I try to do it is so meticulous, it is meaningful. My friends sometimes get irritated with me because they go like, why are you so controlled about it? And I go, because we have to work on our friendship. I know it seems like it's just going to happen, but we have to work on it. When are we having this dinner? We have a song that we sing, which is called Are You Ready for the Question? And we sing it maybe like the fourth or fifth night of every hangout.
In the restaurant? You're at that table?
Yeah, we sing it. We sing it. Are you ready for the question? Are you ready for the question? But one of the big things I've been worried about recently is young men and how angry they've become. How angry they've become, how alone they've become, how isolated they've become. Mm-hmm. And then ironically, how they've turned that anger, isolation mm-hmm. into a community. Mm-hmm. And it's weird because it's literally, there's communities of young men online who have formed communities based in and around loneliness, mm-hmm. based in and around anger, based, and they don't try and become, it's interesting that you're saying all these things, they don't try and become friends.
Yeah. Or moving to violence to solve my problems. And especially if you come from a shame-based society, and when you find other people who are suffering what you're suffering or who get you, it's incredibly compelling, and you feel seen and you feel understood. And the work of Dia Khan, the British documentarian, you know, she talks about this, whether you're talking about white supremacists or we're talking about jihadis, they are not driven by hate. They are driven by love. And her work is all about it. And this is what we don't understand, which is it's people who are missing love, desperately looking for love, and desperately looking for belonging. And when our nations don't provide us, this is getting into much sort of like, but when our leaders, and you and I have talked about this, which is in the world today, I think there's been a total loss of idealism.
Yeah.
You know, our leaders used to talk about world peace and peace on earth. You and I having a conversation about world peace right now would sound cheesy and corny and weird. And I think there's been a loss of idealism. And when there's a loss of idealism and something to feel like we belong to larger than ourselves, larger than our nation, larger than the work that we do, if that's missing, we still look for that. We still look for that belonging, but unfortunately we find it down here.
Right.
And I think we're witnessing the loss of idealism in the world right now, how we're finding community at low levels and tearing each other apart.
And I've spoken to some of you in the audience here, by the way, you know, I mean, some of the most successful people, venture capital, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and our parents and everything. And at some of the dinners, at some of the moments that we've had together, I've asked some of you, and I won't, you know, single you out, but a lot of people have said, hey, and how's your friend group? And they go, oh man, I actually haven't seen my friends in a while, and I haven't, and you don't know, and do you think there is a way to find the balance between showing up as a family person, showing up as a mother, showing up as a father, showing up as, you know, that nuclear unit, showing up as a CEO, showing up as a president, showing up? Do you think it's possible to show up in those worlds and then still make room for what society has deemed a nice to have? Because friendship is never seen as, you know, the thing. Like, I came here last year with a friend as a plus one, and I remember a few people like, who's this? And I was like, my friend. They're like, but what does he do? I was like, he's my friend. And they're like for a living? I was like, yeah, I'd like to think so. Yeah. And obviously he does things, but to me, he's my friend. I don't know what he does in that. Obviously I do, but I don't care. And I wonder if you like think about that, you know, for rooms like this where people are so high powered and so intense and you know, they focus and they go, family business. I hear a lot of people say that. I hear very people say, friends, I really, really work hard on my friendships. What do you say to that?
It is more amazing to have an amazing experience with someone than by yourself. You can go do it by yourself and say, look what I did, versus, do you remember that time we did that? And I think that we, especially for leaders, and I criticize, I think leaders bear greater responsibility because people follow their leaders.
Yeah.
So goes the leader, so goes the organization. So goes the leader, so goes the country, always. So goes the parents, so go the children, mm-hmm. right? Put your phones away, mom and dad are on their phone the whole time at dinner, right?
Right.
And I think if the leader publicly said, I just want everybody to know it's Monday, Friday I'm leaving a little early, it's my friend's birthday, and we're going to go celebrate, you'll find people prioritizing their friends more. I think it's a leadership problem.
I think it's something we all have to work on. And one other thing that I've realized in talking to people, just anecdotally, and then, you know, therapists who are really good studying in this space, is I think we shouldn't take for granted how much the abandoning or the ignoring of friendships has affected romantic relationships, because people have now shifted all of the expectation, all of the support, all of the, you know, the love that they got from a community of friends, and they've moved it on to one person. And a lot of the, I think there's a few studies that have actually shown even having a friend where you can talk shit about your partner too, which is healthy, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually improves your chances of staying with your partner.
Oof, that's. I'm having an insight here. This is. Thank you for being the truffle pig, and uncovering this magical little insight. That the same thing is happening at work is happening in our relationships. So it used to be where we sort of had bowling leagues and we got our community from there.
Yes.
We got our sense of belief from church. Work was the place we made our living. We had barbecues with our neighbors. And over time, those things have disappeared. And now we demand of our work that you be the place of purpose. You be the place of community.
Yeah.
You be the place of my social life. Now you be the place that matches my politics. We're putting all this pressure on work to fulfill every desire I have. And we're doing the exact same thing in our relationships, which is we've seemed to abandon in those outside places, and we're asking of our partners to be everything all the time, always, which is an unreasonable and unfair standard to put on someone or be put on us.
I've never thought about it from the workplace as well, and that's why you're my favorite truffle pig. I know Anastasia has time to run, so I'll leave you with one thing that really, you know, for me was perfectly apt for this conversation, and it's a saying that we have in South Africa, in Zulu, which is umuntu ngumuntu ngabantu, which means a person is a person only because of the people. And I want to say that I'm genuinely a better person because of you, my friend. Thank you for being here with me.
So that was just Trevor Noah and Simon Sinek. So we're moving on. This is a short conversation just talking about friendship, and I kind of covered the counterpoint to the rat study. The next thing we're moving on to is a little snippet from the Longevity Project. So this one is basically covering some of the positive effects of sociability, how it affects your health, and other things. Later on, we'll be moving on to Susan Pinker. And the second half of the show is just going to be basically covering Henry David Thoreau, who is widely, most people widely associate with someone that lives out in the woods, is socially isolated. But basically the cut up that I'm bringing is, if you ever read his autobiography, you realize how much sociology, how much his social life really affected his work. And even his cabin in the woods was a social hub in the community. So, but with that said, we're moving on to the Longevity Project, and it's going to be a little short snippet. Once again, 656-4399.
In September 1921, a girl named Patricia and her precocious classmate John were pulled out of their San Francisco classrooms by a Stanford University psychologist, Lewis Terman. Dr. Terman was looking for gifted children and had asked their teachers to pick out the brightest kids in the class. He was interested in the sources of intellectual leadership and wondered if he could identify early glimmers of high potential. 80 years later, both Patricia and John were still alive at 91 years old. They had beaten the odds and lived very long and healthy lives. What was their secret? In an effort to find out, we have spent the past 20 years following up on the people in Dr. Terman's studies and investigating why some people thrive well into old age, while others fall ill and die prematurely. Along the way, we've discovered that many common health recommendations are ill-advised or simply wrong. We've replaced those with more accurate guideposts to a longer, healthier life. The 1,500 or so bright boys and girls selected by Dr. Terman were born around 1910. Almost all of them are now gone. We have documented when and how they died, and we have studied their lives in meticulous detail. Although many died by their 60s, many others aged in good health and lived well into old age. Surprisingly, the long-lived among them did not find the secret to health in broccoli, medical tests, vitamins, or jogging. Rather, they were individuals with certain constellations of habits and patterns of living. Their personalities, career trajectories, and social lives proved highly relevant to their long-term health, often in ways we did not expect. The researchers generally do their best to be as accurate as possible, But there are always limits in a complex study of human health. And the statistics that emerge from the studies can be interpreted in many different ways. One of the best ways to avoid research traps and biases is to follow individuals for their entire lives and see which characteristics influence subsequent qualities, behaviors, and outcomes. What exactly causes people with similar backgrounds to diverge in terms of their health and well-being? This step-by-step procedure is exactly what we have done. The Amazing Study. When Dr. Terman began studying Patricia and John, and these hundreds of other bright boys and girls in California, he collected all sorts of valuable information about the children's families, schooling, and activities. He recorded how many books were in their houses, how active they were in their playtime, and how happy their parents' marriages were. He measured their personalities. Were they prudent, extroverted, cheerful? He then followed his participants as they grew up, made career choices, and had families of their own. When he launched the study in 1921, Dr. Terman was in his mid-40s. He died in 1956, but the project continued, carried on by others. We began serious work on this study in 1990, and so often use the phrases our study or our project when talking about analyses, findings, and interpretations. But this is not in any way intended to ignore or minimize the tremendous debt we all owe to Dr. Terman, to his collaborators, and to the Terman participants and their families. Social support and long life. To determine which aspects of social ties were prominent on the path to long life, we examined how the various aspects of social support, at around retirement age, were related to mortality risk over the ensuing two decades. We figure that if a Terman participant sincerely felt that he or she had friends and relatives to count on when having a hard time, then that person would be healthier. Those who felt very loved and cared for, we predicted, would live the longest. Surprise, our prediction was wrong. Although other studies have shown that people who feel loved and cared for will report a better sense of well-being, they feel better, we did not find that it helped much for living a long life. What about focusing on the size of social networks, rather than emphasizing only feelings? Does having regular contact with a large number of close, comfortable friends make a difference? A clear finding was that those who had a large social network lived longer. Just as we had seen in our studies of religiosity, social networks matter a lot. Beyond social network size, the clearest benefit of social relationships came from helping others. Those who helped their friends and neighbors, advising and caring for others, tended to live to old age. Those like Barbara, who had large networks and good social relations because they helped others, were reaping a real benefit in terms of their longevity. We saw again and again that it was not the feel-good aspects of having friends that was associated with long life. Rather, it was the more hands-on pieces that mattered most, being in contact with family members, doing things with friends, and helping others. When taken in total with the many other characteristics of long life, being conscientious, being in a good marriage, having healthy habits, and working hard in a successful career, Defoe's adage really crumbles. While his catchy saying has become a truism, repeated endlessly over the years in movies, songs, and philosophies, there's no real evidence that the good die young. In fact, although there are always some exceptions, which are therefore notable, generally speaking, it's the good ones who can actually help shape their fate. The bad die early, and the good do great. Our findings suggest that someone who scores lots of points from feeling religious or from watching television evangelists will not likely have the same experiences or positive outcomes as someone who is actively engaged in a religious community. For the Terman men, and often for men more generally, the relevance of religion to health is overwhelmed by other influences, their families, and their careers. The Terman men relied more on their wives in social realms, and so religious ties were less important to their health. And those unmarried but healthy men like John, who was not at all religious in the traditional sense, yet still lived a long life, usually maintained close relationships with friends and colleagues outside the context of religious organizations. Some people feel they are not devout enough, and they resolve to meditate further or to spend more hours in prayer. While this makes many people feel better and more compassionate, our findings suggest that these practices are not central to health promotion. Instead, the good health habits fostered by religious practice, and especially the social engagement that is so much a part of religious community, are the likely explanations for the health of many religious folks. Are pets truly substitute friends? Animals often provide their owners with love, purpose, and security. Some researchers even suggest that pets are a good substitute for human companionship. It's true that animals can encourage healthy behaviors. When you take your dog for a daily walk, you are also getting a walk. And they encourage a degree of responsibility and organization. As pet owners and fans, we weren't about to argue a broad case against the benefits of having pets, but over the long term, we wanted to see whether regularly interacting with pets produced measurable health benefits for the Terman participants. In 1977, when they were in their 60s, the subjects were asked how often they played with their pets. Never, seldom, occasionally, or frequently. This was the perfect question because we didn't care if someone had a pet but never interacted with that pet. Using this question and the long life data, we looked to see whether those who played more with pets were more likely to survive over the next 14 years. Another surprise. They were not. Not at all. Perhaps many of these pet aficionados already had good social support from people, meaning that animal companionship had little to add. If this were true, playing with pets would not be important for the group as a whole, but it might be quite important for those who were socially isolated. For them, pets could be filling in the gap that would otherwise be filled with people. We ran these statistical analyses again, this time looking just at the socially isolated, but the results were the same. Playing with pets wasn't associated with longer life. We had to conclude that urging your elderly aunt, who really doesn't like animals, to get a dog so she will have a health-promoting companion is probably not a worthwhile idea. Having a pet is great if it brings joy to your life, but we found no evidence that it will provide the social enrichment that is so important to long life. What it means for you, guideposts to health and long life. The lives of the Terman participants showed that taking time to cultivate social networks is important not just to the quality of life, but also to its quantity. Feeling good, staying calm, and breathing deeply can be signs of health, but they are not its root causes. Instead, social relations should be the first place to look for improving health and longevity. You may recall from the last chapter that John was not a religious person. Yet, he lived a long life, and his social ties were a big part of his secret. For John, becoming more religious would not likely have improved his longevity, because he was already enjoying the strongest benefits of being religious, the social elements. In contrast, Donna's case is one where congregational life could have made a huge difference. Donna didn't spend much time with friends or colleagues, focusing instead on raising her sons and just getting by after her divorce. When her sons were grown, Donna pretty much quit going to church and became even more socially isolated. If Donna had instead become more involved in her church or some other meaningful organizations, using her considerable intelligence to join with others to make a difference in her community, it very well might have improved her prospects for a long life. John and Barbara found social connections in their careers. Barbara maintained additional social links through her congregation and extended network of friends. Linda's ties were mostly through family and church groups, but the effect remained the same. It was not those who felt the most connected and appreciated, but those who had many actual ties in their social networks, and who were engaged with helping others who lived longest. It is worth reiterating that social networks represent an important, perhaps the most important, way to change one's life pathway. In many ways, it is also a very doable fix, in a relatively straightforward manner. Repairing a troubled marriage or unproductive career is also very important to health, but is quite difficult and will take a lot of time. In contrast, setting aside a few hours each week to volunteer or joining a group that shares one of your passions increases the size of your social network and provides opportunities to help others. You're never too old, and it's never too late or too early to start this, and the returns can be enormous in terms of life's quality and quantity. The Road to Resilience. The highly successful Hollywood director, Edward Dmytryk, one of the hardest-working Terman subjects, led one of the most stressful lives but lived to age 90. Those who cared about others, who were agreeable but not necessarily sociable, often thrived even in the face of adversity. Like Dmytryk, they sought out the best in others, which was a key road to resilience. The same could be said of those children who faced the divorce of their parents. Those who got back on track with a sense of accomplishment in their careers and a happy marriage of their own lived long lives. We didn't find that competition and drive are unhealthy characteristics. On the contrary, those who were the most disappointed with their achievements died the youngest. It would be naive to think that successful Hollywood directors like Dmytryk, TV writers like Jess Oppenheimer, and the like, cannot compete and throw an elbow at their opponent if needed. But they had the persistence, the motivation, and especially the support of a spouse or a close friend to come back each time they faced a challenge. Resilience was not a trait they were born with, nor an inner insight, but a process of perseverance and hard work. The persistent, consequential, and social life. The 1,528 Terman participants were all quite intelligent, with a good start in life. By age 10, they were doing well in school, were noticed by their teachers, and were being investigated by a Stanford professor, Lewis Terman. Many went on to be successful, but quite a large number of their fellow participants faced regular disappointments in love, in careers, and in length of life. Some who succeeded were lucky, but many others made their own luck. Across the lifespan, many predictors emerged as to who would do better and who would do worse, who would live longer and who would die younger. It was not good cheer or being popular and outgoing that made the difference. It was also not those who took life easy, played it safe, or avoided stress who lived the longest. Rather, it was those who, through an often complex pattern of persistence, prudence, hard work, and close involvement with friends and communities, headed down meaningful, interesting life paths, and as we have illustrated, found their way back to these healthy paths each time they were pushed off the road. But having a large social network, engaging in physical activities that naturally draw you in, giving back to your community, enjoying and thriving in your career, and nurturing a healthy marriage or close friendships can do more than add many years to your life. Together, they represent the living with purpose that comes from working hard, reaching out to others, and bouncing back from difficult times. How fascinating to understand that those individuals who became involved with others in a consequential life would be improving their health as an unanticipated bonus.
I met women too, and here you see Zia Teresa. She at.
So that was just a snippet from the Longevity Project, basically covering the Terran research subjects and basically kind of summing up some of the findings that they found for the study. It is basically the amount of social engagement was a huge factor on how long and happy these people's lives were. And it's one of the largest and most long-term studies ever done